This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. These next 2 weeks are a mini-series focusing on that still so maligned and butt of so many jokes string instrument, the viola. We'll chat with two very different but important young artists playing this soulful string instrument. We'll begin today with Richard O'Neill, born in Washington State to a disabled Korean mother who was adopted and raised by strong-valued American parents. My guest's early life was one of some hardships, including bigotry and discrimination, trying to find his roots. But his talent and love of music let him rise above, and his success, both here and abroad, especially in South Korea, speaks for itself. A recipient of the Avery Fisher Career Grant, he's also won an Emmy Award for his work in South Korea, bringing classical music to thousands who may never have had the opportunity, and being nominated for 3 Grammy Awards. The most recent Grammy nomination was this past year as soloist in the Viola Concerto by renowned American composer Christopher Theofanidis, with David Allen Miller leading the Albany Symphony Orchestra and released on the Albany label. You're listening to the opening minutes of the concerto, inspired by Navajo poetry. The first movement is titled Black Dancer, Black Thunder. My guest's solo career is wildly successful, again, especially and frustratingly abroad, since many of his recordings, due to licensing, are not readily available here in the U.S. Though his presence on disc will change, as last year he was named and now settles in as only the 4th violist to hold the chair in the esteemed Takash String Quartet. I spoke with Richard O'Neill via Zoom a couple weeks back. Mm-hmm. very happy today to be talking with violist Richard O'Neill. When we turned on, I thought I'd be talking to you from Boulder, Colorado, but you said you are in LA. You grew up in Washington State. You did schooling in North Carolina and New York City and Los Angeles. You spent some very important time with some important projects in South Korea. But the recent developments of your life do have this kind of magnetic pull to Boulder and Colorado University. I was just curious how this is all fitting in. I mean, everything seems to be fitting into your life right now, and Boulder seems to be where you're going to be centered, correct?
It is actually where I'm centered. This is a very quick trip just to make sure that my place in LA hasn't fallen down.
Yeah.
Since June, I've been living in Boulder full-time, basically, with the Takash Quartet, and starting last fall with at CU Boulder, which has been just an amazing development and progress for me to be in such a wonderful university with great colleagues. And then, in my opinion, you know, as a member of one of the great string quartets of the world, it's such an honor.
I wanted to jump into this with you because I think your life story is I don't know if you will agree with this, but it kind of presents a scaffolding for how you've presented your career, your artistry, who you are. And just a real thumbnail, I said you grew up in Washington State. Your mother was a Korean foster child. She was raised by her American parents. She was disabled. She and you faced anti-Asian discrimination. You grew up surrounded by some tragedy, obviously the bigotry I just said, self-determination. Will, your grandmother really showed a strong female presence that you could see, you know, how to get through some of this. Your mother provided a musical background. You found out information about your biological father late in life, which was almost too late to get into the narrative. I mean, it's such a story that if you just think, oh, very talented kid, starts on violin, switches to viola, you know, there's 100,000 stories like that. But your story is very different, and your story took a lot of courage and determination and things. I'm just wondering, take parts of that to tell our audience how that has affected who you are today.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if you had the opportunity to sit everyone down and ask them to reveal, truly reveal all of their life, the light and the dark, you'd have very similar challenges. You know, I think this universe really, it teaches us a lot of things. It gives us a lot of lessons. And I've had a lot of lessons somewhat early on, which helped to sort of give me a very deep sense of gratitude for the ability, the gift, the luxury of making music for others. And I think maybe that's the essence of what an artist, I mean, I really think music is there because words really fall short so many times. And we have a lot of challenges in life, everyone, and a lot of unexplainable events and a lot of happiness, a lot of sadness, a lot of loss, a lot of joy. And I think everything in between. And music was given to us by some of these wonderful composers, many who are long gone, but some that we're lucky enough to have alive, very much alive. And it really brings us together in it. I think there's so much in today's world that is because of words and because of their meaning, it really, there's so much misunderstanding. And I think with music, I don't think that's ever a problem. Music is that magical language that no matter what you get from it, there's no wrong way to interpret music. You just receive it, and whatever your state of consciousness, whoever you are, it speaks to you individually. And I think that's why I've always gravitated towards that language. When I was a young child, I grew up with some adult men that had Down syndrome. I learned from a very young age that everyone has their own way of communicating. You just have to listen. And sometimes it's not verbal, but everyone, every being has their way of sort of communicating. And I think music is as one of those languages. You have that ability if you open yourself to it and you, of course, put in the work and the discipline and you commit to it, to be rewarded with how infinitely profound and deep and universal the language is.
As you went on and you had some of these really, you know, sort of hard turns in your life or things you had to get past, the choice to go to viola, I know it was kind of a, hey, kid, play viola, you know, but it also gives you an instrument that you can really find your own voice on, because there's easily 25-1, maybe more than that, violinists to violists of the world. I don't know what the ratio is, but I mean, did the eventual settling on viola also help you sort of find this voice through a childhood and parts of your life that were not easy?
Oh, for sure. I think that's one of the challenges of being a young classical musician studying is there is, of course, this great tradition and past, which I think, in my opinion, everyone has to sort of understand their place in it. But at the same time, sometimes it can be very frightening because right. there's these sort of more or less sometimes very rigid ways of these camps of people that think this is how music is, this is how Bach should be played, this is how you hold the instrument, this is where you need to go to school, this is the sort of pedigree you need to. And I'm feeling like that, yes, there's still elements of that, but it's evolving. But I think there was something about me choosing the viola and sort of going all in and taking a big risk and leaving home and just standing at the edge of the cliff for many years that really just was sort of liberating. For some people, either there's shame involved, like, oh, I'll be embarrassed because somebody won't like it or I'll be criticized. But for me, I was standing at the edge of the cliff and I was like, what do I have to lose? You know, really, what do I have to lose? If this is really about growth and development and exploring this infinitely profound language, you know, it's all a learning experience, rehearsal, performance, lessons, and not just in the practice room or everything that life throws at you. And playing the violas, I think most violists, I think all violists that I know, at least that I have in my life, they're great listeners. They want to make the music come alive. They don't necessarily right. have to be the spotlight. They don't have to be the protagonist. They're just happy in whatever role that they're placed, whether that yeah. be in a quartet, in an orchestra, or maybe in this instance with this recording, like standing in front of the orchestra. They're very, they listen and they care about others and they're sympathetic.
So my guest violist Richard O'Neill cut his recording teeth with works of the great 20th century English composer William Walton from a Deutsche Grammophon release, not available in hard copy here, titled British Viola. Here he is as soloist in Walton's Viola Concerto. This is the second movement. My guest is accompanied by Sir Andrew Davis and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Thank you. in what you did with your career then, sort of giving our listeners the sort of the background, is you kind of threw yourself into bringing classical music and performance opportunities to those who may never have it, especially a lot of work you did in South Korea, which you've been rewarded for, you've gotten recognition and all that. And then you also worked with a roster of some of today's brightest and best known composers. It's funny because it seems like your early life, you said, I'm going to transform this into something where I help others along the way. And we mentioned the new music commitment. We should say that, I mean, you kind of cut your teeth on the viola on like 20th century, you know, William Walton is where you kind of cut your teeth on the viola, which is kind of a weird door into the viola. But talk about your work in South Korea. I mean, you should be proud of this work you've been doing. So just talk about why give so much time to these type of endeavors.
Well, I first went to South Korea in my early 20s as a member of this wonderful Korean ensemble called the Sejong Soloists, which is based out of New York City. And I had moved to Manhattan to start at Juilliard in August of 2001. And we all know what happened very shortly thereafter. And amidst all the tragedy, I got this call, would you like to audition for this group? You know, we tour the world, we play with all these soloists, and we'll give you a beautiful Gaspar de Salo viola to use. It's like, well, hey, why not? You know, and so at that time, it really worked with my graduate studies at Juilliard to join this group. And it's led by a wonderful professor there, Hyo Kong, who is still a dear friend and a mentor. And in December of 2001, we were asked to go to Korea, Taiwan, and Japan to tour with the violinist Kyung Hwa Chung on this huge tour. It was the largest tour and the farthest I'd ever been away, but it was life-changing. And one of the life-changing things about that is I think we're having dinner in Osaka, having sushi in Osaka, and some members of the group were like, you don't really look like your last name. And I was like, well, you know, that's sort of a complicated thing to say, but I sort of explained what my history with my mom being a Korean war orphan and suffering from some handicaps because of malnutrition or living on the streets. We never really knew what happened. But I was saying, you know, this is very meaningful for me because this is my first trip stepping foot, you know, in the motherland. And that led to a whole bunch of things, including looking for many years for my blood family, which was ultimately unsuccessful in finding biologically related people, but successful in the sense that I was given this family of people in Korea that have been like my family and embraced and given opportunities there that I would have never thought possible in my wildest dreams, you know, as projects to play whatever recitals I want every year for viola repertoire and have people come. A chamber music project that brought, you know, many, many, many people to chamber music that had never been. Some wonderful projects to fight for things that I believe in, like fight against racism in Korea with a youth orchestra of multicultural children that were suffering, you know, as children, you know, and try to bring that to, you know, and trips to all over the world with NGOs, to Kenya to play for some people in the North Rift Valley. It was just unbelievable gifts of experience that, I mean, I look back now and I was like, wow, that's, I'm so lucky that I got to do all of that, because people basically in Korea, rather than sort of look at my mom's situation and judge her, they embraced her and they understood, because there's so many millions of Koreans, I think, that have suffered after the war and that really understood my mom's plight coming to the United States. And then me being her son and trying to honor her and trying to do my best to spread music everywhere I can.
I mean, it's all very laudable stuff. You know, you've got a long career ahead of you too. So you've done all this stuff already, which is very commendable. Here's my guest violist Richard O'Neill in recordings he made in South Korea performing with the Joy of Strings Ensemble, two pieces from Dmitri Shostakovich, from that composer's incidental music to The Gadfly, the famous romance, and then the waltz from the Jazz Suite No. 2. mentioned how some of the work you did in Korea got recognized. There was like an Emmy Award for some of that stuff. You just got your third Grammy nomination. And speaking of, you know, embracing new music, and again, you're a violist. So anything you do with new music widens the repertoire of this instrument, which is always wanted and always needed. But this latest Grammy nomination was on the Albany label with the Albany Symphony Orchestra. And it was this viola concerto composed by
Christopher Theofanidis,
who over the many years of this program, I've had hundreds of great composers as guests. He's still on the list. I haven't had him yet. He's going to come soon. One of these days I'll have Christopher on. It's a mysterious work at times. It's inspired some of it by Navajo poetry. The last movement comes into the events of 9/11, and specifically the composer went to that interfaith gathering at Yankee Stadium, and he heard a Sikh singer singing a melody which just caught into his head, and that made it into this piece. I hate to say this word. It's a very approachable piece, but it really has a strange personality. So talk about how you got hooked up with this whole project with Christopher, with the recording, and then just talk about the work a little bit.
In my many years at the Chamber Music Society at Lincoln Center, one of my favorite artists there is a guy named Jimmy Lin, Chow Lang Lin.
Yeah, he's been a past cadenza guest.
Oh, great. And Jimmy is such a mensch. And So Jimmy one day is like, we were playing a trout quintet with Manny Axe, and we just got talking. He's like, you know, I think you need to meet my friend David Allen Miller up in Albany. And I was like, great, sure. Then years passed. And then I got this email from the Albany Symphony. Would you like to play this concerto by Christopher Theofanidis? And said, sure, that's great. And we worked out the dates and it all worked out. And then I got a call from Chris saying, I'd like to meet you while you're in New York at CMS, Lincoln Center, so we can talk about my piece. We're going to basically be performing, you're going to be performing and recording in a couple of weeks. So we met at some coffee shop near Lincoln Center. And I was just immediately taken with Chris. He's such a gentle, listening, wise, and kind person. And his description of his music has this sort of gravitas that really means so much to him. And when he described the duress under which he composed the work, which is written for the great violist Kim Kashkashian, who I know and adore, and it has a lot of her fire, just this incredible fire in it. But he was writing the piece, and then 9/11, of course, changed everyone's lives. And me being a newbie New Yorker and him being in the city for a long time, it was just one of those, it changed everyone on the planet. And I think it sort of threw the piece into sort of this sort of, how should I resolve? So I think the third movement is really very, very, very powerful. It has a direct quotation of that prayer service or the interfaith service. It basically travels from the dark to sort of to the light. So meaningful. The whole sweep of the piece. I mean, the whole way it begins with those sort of those drum beats, those sort of ominous drum beats. And then the first movement ends with the whole orchestra just in this sort of primal, you know, D-centric, these chords, and the viola is just left on its own. And then the second movement being basically this very philosophical discussion of me basically putting out all these questions. Like, it's almost like a big cadenza, the whole movement. Like, I keep on asking of the audience, the universe, what is this about? What is it? And just getting no response, and the viola getting more and more and more sort of frustrated that it's just, there's no answer. And the third movement, of course, being that amazing transformation of the chic melody. And then the fourth movement being the complete conclusion of the concerto and its sort of me. The poetry, I think I found the poems that Kim was looking at, they're very evocative. And I think it's really very terse and very sort of open-ended. I think his choice of that language, especially amidst such deep tragedy, unspeakable tragedy of that day and such loss for so many, I think it really sort of captured in sort of, I don't know how, the poetry almost lives the land. It really respects the land and it evokes the sort of land. And I think a lot of the piece, I don't know if you've ever driven through the American Southwest where there's all open space. It really feels like that. A lot of the piece is just very like you're driving through these open desert scenes where there's just very nothing. And there's a lot of nothingness. I think he gets that through the language of the piece.
When you have a piece like this that gets the recognition of like a Grammy nomination, Does that perk up other orchestras and conductors to maybe want other performances of it?
I hope so. I think that's mainly the challenge I've encountered in my life trying to play works I believe in with all my heart. The first performance often happens, but the second and third are the challenge, because a lot of times people don't want to take the financial risk of not selling out a multi-thousand seat hall with very expensive orchestra to take a chance on a composer that's living. And I find that just, that's been one of the challenges in my life, is to try to convince people that yes, this music will move people. When we played it in Albany, I was shocked, but both performances were packed in the Troy Savings Bank, which is one of my favorite places to play in the world. And it was packed. It was a New Year's concert with Beethoven 5 on the second half. But the minute it finished, people stood up and they were just so moved. And I was so like, wow, it spoke to people. And to have a work of our time that nobody's heard before have that reaction, I was like, this piece really, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, people loved the piece, and I'm so thrilled for Chris that it got this nomination because it really deserves it. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful work.
So let's dip back into my guest's Grammy-nominated recording of the Viola Concerto by Christopher Theofanidis, with David Alan Miller leading the Albany Symphony Orchestra and released on the Albany label. A portion here of the third movement, titled The Center of the Sky, where the composer was inspired by and used a Sikh song sung at the Interfaith Memorial Gathering held at Yankee Stadium after 9/11. The soloist, my guest today, violist Richard O'Neill. Now, I kind of let drop that this was your third Grammy nomination, and I should say that you have actually sold of your recordings, like close to about 250,000 recordings. Now, if people go looking for those recordings, you are a universal artist on of none other than Deutsche Grammophon imprint. But most of those recordings, they're not available physically here in the US because of districting and all this kind of record licensing stuff, and get them some downloads. So that's, Richard, kind of frustrating if we want to hear your artistry, that you really have to hunt them if you're here in the States. But there are a lot of really great recordings all the way from the Baroque work you did up through modern pieces. And however, something that happened to you last year will probably bring you more into a more regular discography, not as a solo artist, but as one of a quartet. You are, I think June is when you assumed the position of being only the fourth violist in the world-renowned Takash Quartet. So congratulations, but how did this all come about?
Well, for your listeners, the Takash Quartet, you know, it's a real institution. I mean, it is one of the sort of preeminent quartets of the world right now. And I've been listening to them ever since they had their spectacular Beethoven cycle on Decca and Bartok cycle. Right. For a lot of us that were studying music at the time, when that cycle came out, it was like, everybody was like, wow, what an amazing gift to have that cycle and the Emersons now and the Tokios. And it was part of like these, to geek out, it was like, wow, it's such, I think the Takash captured something in those quartets that was just so special. And their Beethoven cycle too, which also won a Grammy, the Rasimovsky set. So I knew about the quartet for many, many years. And as an aside, I auditioned for them shortly after I moved to New York. They were looking for a violist after Roger Tapping had announced his retirement. And I was a young whippersnapper, and I really wanted a secret wish, or not so secret now, is like I wanted to be in a quartet. That's always right. What I wanted to be in ever since I started playing the viola. So of course I didn't win the position back then, but Ed Dusenberry, the first violinist, was very kind. And he said, you know, you really should focus on your solo career. You have all these things with Universal, and you need to chase after that dream. And I'm so glad in some ways, it was painful at the time because I was disappointed. But now I look back, I was like, I'm glad I got all that experience doing all these crazy projects and not having to have to be bound by one direction, but just to pick and choose at my will and what would make me a better musician. So fast forward to a few years ago at Santa Barbara, sunny Santa Barbara in the summer, where the Takash Quartet now is in residency at the Music Academy of the West, where I'm also on faculty and where I was also a student. And the Music Academy was one of my favorite memories of all of my student years. It really helped launch me. And to be back as faculty and then with the Takash Quartet was so nice. And I was taken out by the second violinist, the new second violinist, or not so new, Harumi Rhodes, who was a dear friend and one of my former colleagues at CMS Lincoln Center Society 2, where I guess it's called the Bowers Program now, but it's their Young Artist Apprentice Program. We were both there at the same time. Harumi is just a bona fide genius. I mean, she understands so much about everything. And I've always loved making music with her. And so she was talking to me and the conversation got started, and it was sort of announced that Jerry would be leaving and they would be having a search and if I'd be interested. And I said, I'd be very interested. I'm already a member of a wonderful, wonderful quartet with some of my greatest friends, with the violinist James Ennis. But I auditioned and it was very clear that that was the way it was going to go. And so it's been a dream come true. I mean, for a violist, I think one would be crazy not to want to be in a string quartet. I mean, the repertoire for viola in a quartet is just unmatched. All of the greats left some of their most personal and beautiful statements in that genre. And if you're lucky enough to find a situation where you can basically survive and flourish and be in a situation where you can throw yourself headlong into that, I would say go for it. And it's been a long, non-circuitous journey to that point, you know, of reaching, but I feel like, you know, it's a life dream come true.
There are so many string quartets on the scene today, many of them young and very talented, but to go into the Takash, it's like, you know, you're going into something that's so established and so recognized. I mean, what a cool thing. Can you divulge anything the Takash is, what are they thinking of, discussions of what they're going to move on to now as far as recording wise?
I would love to tell you. I don't know if I'm at...
Just curious.
We've been so lucky that Hyperion, Simon Perry and Hyperion has been throughout all of the world turning upside down. Hyperion has honored their commitment, and we've been recording basically by this spring. We'll have recorded 2 discs already during this pandemic, and that news will be released shortly by Hyperion. But it's been, this pandemic, for all the people you've probably talked to, has been an extreme challenge. And for the quartet as well. I mean, we've been so lucky. Like, actually, Marna at Princeton has been one of our big supporters. Right. And we're fortunate for people like them that have really gone to extremely great lengths to present the quartet virtually. So we've been very busy with those virtual concerts, which have been a challenge. I think, like all artists, we miss playing for live people.
I mean, you got officially appointed in June, COVID pandemic already underway. So when was the first time the 4 of you actually got to sit down together in the same room and play?
June. It was June.
It was June. Okay. All right.
I had just made a calculated risk and traveled to Korea for a month-long tour. And then I came back safe, didn't contract anything on the plane. Yeah. And I packed up my car and I drove over to the Rockies overnight. And I just camped out and in Harumi's for the month, trying to find a place, which is very difficult. You can imagine people aren't really that willing to want to show you places during COVID. So that was a real challenge. I mean, I'd started that process in April, but thanks to Andras and Harumi and Ed, I was able to find a place. But Peter Ungen from the Colorado Music Festival, he sort of saved my debut, because a lot of my planned concerts, of course, they were all just wiped clean. And Peter was like, being a very amazing quartet player himself in the Tokyos, another hero of mine, he offered to present our debut with me in Chautauqua, not in the New York Chautauqua, but the Boulder Chautauqua Auditorium, which is an amazing space. And it was quite a program. It was Bartok 2, 59, 3, Quartet Sats, Debussy. It really sort of threw me in the deep end. I was amazed, but it was, I don't know how to describe it, but you know, when you join something that's been going on for that long, talking about tradition and way things have been, you feel that seriousness of all of those hard fought years and musical arguments and life. And you feel that because you're stepping into a seat that's, it's like the 4 people that are in the quartet, there's like the 5th element, like this ethos of the quartet that sort of emerges after all those years that you want to honor and do your best to make that be, you know, not to not have any sort of dip in that, but also honor yourself and try to insert your own personality when you can, or not insert your personality, but just be yourself. But Ed and Harumi and Andras have made that very, very easy. They've been so welcoming and open.
Yeah. So even though you're entering this very well established and renowned quartet, you still could feel that you can bring something to it, right?
Yes, yes.
And they wouldn't have wanted you in if they didn't want some kind of new, I mean, it shows the fortitude of the quartet to have somebody like you come in, because they obviously want new ideas and fresh approaches to stuff, because, you know, even quartets can get stale as far as just how they approach things and, you know, doing the same repertoire. All very exciting. I mean, it's very, very cool. Reminder that we have launched into our annual Bach 500 campaign, looking to reach 500 donations in any amount before the great master's birthday on March 21st. It has been a success every year because of you. Please help make it so this year by making that donation at our website, wwfm.org. And as you'll hear, here's an appropriate selection from my guest violist Richard O'Neill. He's performing the Gigue from Bach's Suite for Solo Cello No. 2 in D minor, BWV 1008, from another Deutsche Grammophon recording simply titled Solo. Thank you. you know, you mentioned COVID. I assume that's also played havoc with your teaching and all other aspects of your career. I mean, none of us know when, how, still, yet, even fall, summer, whatever. How has this affected you in a larger scope?
Well, one of the great joys of being in the quartet is the residency at CU Boulder, where I already have some old friends that are members of the faculty. And CU Boulder has been hybrid in person during this whole academic year. It's, of course, an incredible challenge because, you know, COVID, it doesn't rest, you know, and it's so elusive. I mean, if it was one thing, you got tested and you knew you were negative and then you could go about your life, that's one thing, but it's so, so crazy. But CU Boulder has been absolutely amazing. The students have really been adaptable when we've had to shut things down again and open things up, and very supportive, and thank the heavens for this platform Zoom. I mean, I don't know what we would have done without Zoom, without this ability to teach and to see people. So the kids in the viola studio and the music students in general have been, they've been the heroes throughout this all. And my colleagues on the faculty have been so supportive of me being there, even though I haven't met like 95% of them in person yet, right. But it's a very welcoming community and a great school. The Music Academy of the West, we're planning on having a live summer this summer. So it's wish us luck. It's all, I hope with the vaccines and herd immunity, things will change.
Yeah, nobody knows the legacy of what we've had to live over the past year with, like you say, Zoom and virtual versus live, how this is all going to play out. It will change things. It will definitely change things, but I don't think anybody still has a clear idea. Well, we look forward to hearing you with the Takash, hopefully with the Grammy Award for the Viola Concerto. You know, this will give you more recordings that we'll be able to easily get here. And I wish you a great career going forward. I mean, your artistry is wonderful. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting via Zoom, coast to coast here, but with someone from the past, someone who you never had a chance to talk to, but could. I'm just wondering when I ask that, what name pops into your head? You can get flooded, but when I asked that, what was the first name that popped into your head?
Well, if I could speak German, I'd like to speak with Bach. I would really, I would really like to ask him a lot of questions and then just fanboy on him for probably the rest of the time. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, he left the cello suites. There's the violin, solo pieces, sonatas, concertos. Hey, you know, what about the viola?
One of the things that kept me alive during the lockdown, when we first locked down in March, I've always wanted to record the suites. I've recorded a few of them. So I started working, hacking my way through them again. And one of the good things from the pandemic is Universal Korea has signed me up for Deutsche Grammophon for the suites to record them in December. So hopefully I'll make sure that you get a copy. I think it's going to be for LP. So I'll have to send you an LP. But I don't know why that decision, but it will also be available online. But Bach, to me, it's like creation itself. Like, I'm sure, I mean, everyone has their answer, but Bach.
Well, Bach is the runaway number one answer as far as composers. And it's weird because I've had many great, great string players like yourself name Bach, you know, and say, hey, wrote the best string music, you know, and you think Bach, organ, you know, choral, all the sacred music. And it's, you know, that's the way it is.
I don't know if you've been listening to music during when the down days, but like the Goldbergs, if I'm feeling down, I just turn on the Goldbergs. And throughout a lot of my life, when there's been tough times, I just turn on the Goldbergs. And there's something about, especially if you listen to any of the Gould recordings that are Goldberg light, that are just like 35 minutes. There's something about that journey that it's not string music by any means. It's just music. It's the greatest music. And it just never fails to make me feel better about life.
Well, no matter what happens with COVID as we move forward, the solo suites, even played on viola, are a great COVID recording project. So you got that. You got in the can. Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza during normal life fills their life with music. When you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do if you need a respite or just to get away for a while?
I, for many years, was an avid marathoner. Okay. I think about 15 marathons so far, starting in my 30s. And then I had a really bad accident in Korea a few years ago and I busted up my ankle. So recently what I've been doing to also, besides listening to the Goldberg variations to sort of maintain sanity, is going on hikes. And in Boulder, it's like you're living in a national park. Like where I live, South Boulder, I literally go out my door in a minute and I can get on a trail and I can be in the mountains in tens of minutes. It's amazing. Being in nature has really saved, I think, my sanity during this whole thing, is to go out and just reconnect with the eternal and see life. You know, it's great being outdoors.
Well, yeah, and Boulder's a great place to do that. Richard O'Neill, thanks for taking some time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for this time.
Violist Richard O'Neill, you can find out more about him at his website, Richard-O'Neill, O'Neill's run together with no apostrophe, O-N-E-I-L-L, Richard-O'Neill.com. And as he mentioned, now part of the Takash Quartet, their new recordings with Richard will be coming out on the British Hyperion label. I'm going to leave you with the fourth and closing movement from the Viola Concerto by American composer Christopher Theofanidis, for which my guest was nominated for a Grammy. David Alan Miller leads the Albany Symphony, and this is released on the Albany Records label, albanyrecords.com. This movement is titled Lightning with Life in Four Colors Comes Down. The soloist, my guest today, violist Richard O'Neill. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to our website at wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today and have it count towards our Bach 500 at wwfm.org. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.